Now that the battle in Iraq is over, as Karl Rove reminded us the other day, where does the anti-war movement go from here? Is it spreading to the winds, or is it regrouping for the next struggle?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Doug. Let me just start there. I think we have to be very careful when one says that the battle for Iraq is over. I am not at all convinced, and I may be completely off the wall in saying this. I'm not convinced the situation is over, even from a military standpoint. Clearly, the conventional battles are over. The formal Iraqi military was defeated, but the situation is extremely unstable. There were reports today of Shiite-led demonstrations in Baghdad against the U.S. presence. I think it's far from clear what's going to happen there. And so I think that we have to keep our eye on this. Now, I say that both as a point of clarification, but also because I believe that the anti-war movement cannot simply walk away from Iraq now that the formal conflict is over. I think that the issue of the occupation, the role of the U.S. and Britain, the increasing demands for self-determination by the Iraqis necessitate that we keep a focus on that. Not to say that we ignore other issues, but that we continue to do that. I think the second thing is that the anti-war movement in the U.S. is regrouping, and I think it's correct to do that. That right now, in the aftermath of the formal war, we have to reflect on where we are. And one of the troubling currents within this country is this notion that it doesn't matter that they couldn't find these alleged weapons of mass destruction, that this war was okay. And many people, in my opinion, much of the populace, has been suckered into believing that because there were human rights abuses, that in Iraq by the Saddam Hussein regime, that justified the invasion. When that was never a pretext that was used. That was never the main pretext that was offered by Bush. What they did was illegal, and I think it's going to be critically important that the anti-war movement continue to remind people of that. That there's no time clock on justice. The fact that this was a quick war does not make it any more just. So I think that right now the anti-war movement is assessing where it is and trying to figure out, among other things, how to raise the question of empire.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing to start talking about because, you know, when you're organizing about an impending war, you've got something very specific to organize around, to point to, and now we're organizing against something that could be a multi-decade strategy, and you know, Iraq was just one stage in this. How do you organize against or around something that it's really so hard to point to a specific event, but really a whole strategy and a frame of mind that is behind it?
Well, I'll suggest two approaches. One is that there are going to be many battle sites or sites of struggle that we will need to call to the attention of the people of the U.S. Venezuela, Cuba, Colombia, Philippines, Zimbabwe. I mean, the list goes on and on. North Korea. So I think that one of the things that's going to be critical is that there is educational work and organizing around these sites where there is U.S. intervention, where the U.S. is mucking around in the situation. I think that's going to be critical. Overall, though, we have to be engaged in a battle for a democratic foreign policy. I've said this before, and I don't mean democratic party. I mean democratic with a small d, that we have to be involved in a battle for the conscience of the people of the U.S. and a battle that says that a different kind of foreign policy is necessary. I suspect that with this recent wave of terrorist bombings that have taken place in Saudi Arabia and Morocco, as well as the Hamas bombings in Palestine, that people are going to ask themselves the question more and more, are we any safer than we were on September 10th? Are we any safer than we were prior to the invasion of Iraq? Has the Bush policy brought us any more security? I think we have to hammer at this. because, in fact, the Bush policy is not. So I think that that's one issue that's going to be important for the anti-war movement to be raising.
Sometimes it looks like the American population, or a significant chunk of it, enjoys kicking ass and got a kick out of what happened in Iraq. Compounding that may be a sense that if people see terrorist attacks, that'll just deepen their resolve. We have to go after these evil guys. So how do you fight against those kinds of militaristic and jingoistic impulses, which certainly not what arise when we see events, but may arise in different sets of the population?
Oh, man, I think you've hit the question. Well, let me start with this. I think a section of the population of the United States will simply never be convinced. I think we have to accept that. And I think it's an unfortunate thing, but I think that racism and jingoism is so deeply rooted in sections of the population that some people will just, that's going to be the way that they're going to be. Having said that, I think most people don't want airplanes flying into our buildings. Most people were traumatized by those attacks, followed by the scares around anthrax, etc. The issue of security is a very real thing, and I think that we have to pose this question of what policies bring about security. And are they the policies that are being pursued by the Bush administration? Are they other policies? That's what I think has to be held in front of the people of the United States. And because you're right. I mean, there are people that are deeply influenced by jingoism. There are also a lot of people that are running scared. And the fear, some of the fear is a fear that's the result of terrorism, but some of the fear is a fear that's a result of the collapse of their own lives, that their situation has changed. Their living standard has declined. The people aren't necessarily sure why. They're lashing out, looking for some sort of enemy. And there are a lot of enemies that are held up by the Bush administration and their political allies that we should be opposing. And I think that that misdirects people away from the problems here at home. And so I think that that's also part of the task of the anti-war movement.
Yeah, well, this is a nice point of transition then, because Karl Rove and the other Bush strategists would like as much as possible to keep the entire national attention focused on, you know, these security matters, terrorism, the fight against evil. Meanwhile, the economy is not in great shape, and there are many of the state and local governments are experiencing a fiscal crisis like they haven't seen for 60 years. How do you challenge the power of the president to set the national agenda, and how do you break that spell of distraction?
I don't think that there's a silver bullet to begin with. And I think that what is called upon us is a certain level of patience and exposures that we have to do constantly of the ramifications of Bush policy here and abroad. You know, things like the $75+ billion that were committed to the war that could have dug out each of the states, all of the states, from their budget deficit. I think that we have to be asking the question, where are the weapons, Mr. Bush? You know, I mean, they can't find them. What does that mean, then, about why we went to war? I think that we have to hammer away at that, regardless of what the polls are supposedly saying about people not caring. I'm not convinced that will remain intact. There is a great deal of insecurity out there. There's a great deal of doubt about the wisdom of the various policies of this administration. I think that part of our role is to encourage that doubt. That's what we were supposed to be doing in the period leading up to the war. That's what we should be doing now, but not just about foreign policy, as well as about domestic policy. The Bush administration has a domestic policy that is completely anti-people. It is rabidly right-wing, rabidly anti-worker. We have to be pointing out in the specifics, this is what this administration is doing. And like I'm saying, I said before, we have to connect that to the fact our security is not any greater. If these guys couldn't get it right on Iraq, in other words, they were telling us that there was this immediate threat, there was this grave danger. Nobody else in the world saw it. And now that this war has been ended. They can't find anything. What does that mean? Does that give us any more confidence in this administration?
How do we raise these issues? I mean, mass demonstrations of the sort that we saw in February and March, for example, it might not be possible to mobilize those numbers of people over this kind of educational, agitational effort. We've got a lot of people now starting to think about organizing for the elections, which may mean let's elect a Democrat and hope everything gets better. What kind of organizational strategies do you have in mind?
Multi-level. I think that there'll have to be certainly involvement in the elections. And I think that in some sense, the election season is important, including for nonprofit organizations and popular organizations, to raise issues, to ask people which candidates stand where on these matters. So I do think that there's a great deal of education that can be done now. The other things that I think that we have to do are much more grassroots. I think, for example, an idea that had been floated in the period leading up to the war, which I happened to really like, was the idea of certain days of neighborhood canvassing. In other words, you identify a day and you get activists to go door to door, preferably in their own neighborhoods, talking to their neighbors and friends about these issues. And that may not sound particularly romantic, but one of the things that's been proven time and again is that people are influenced through one-on-one contact. As much discussion as there is about media hits and television ads, et cetera, the main thing that influences the activity of individuals ends up being one-on-one contact. So I think that there needs to be that level of work. I think that that's also true, for example, in trade unions. That we've had experiences with member-to-member educational programs about the economy, about electoral candidates. I would suggest that there needs to be something along those lines that's done with regard to globalization, with regard to the issues of U.S. foreign policy. That's what's going to be very important. That is going to be the type of thing that builds a core. And I think that there is a role for demonstrations, absolutely. But I think that the demonstrations, particularly given that there is not, knock on wood, this immediate target, the same way that there was in leading up to the Iraq war, I think that the demonstrations are going to have to be focused somewhat differently.
You mentioned the unions, and you used to work for the AFL-CIO.
That's right.
Any sense of what they're up to? Are they going to play along, or are they just going to go into their pre-electoral cheerleading for the Democrats' role?
I think we're going to see a variety of activities. One of the things that was extremely exciting was the development of something called U.S. Labor Against the War, which were union leaders and staff and activists who came together this past January to oppose the move towards war. That group is going to stay together, and they see themselves doing work within the labor movement to try to influence policy. What I'm hoping that they do is that they push before the unions that there needs to be a labor-oriented view on foreign policy, on U.S. foreign policy, that there really has not been that much of one. There have been labor positions on different things, trade deals, etc., but that what's called upon now is what is the point of view of working people in the United States on foreign policy? What kind of foreign policy do we need? So I do expect to see much more of this taking place, you know, in the coming months, and I'm hoping that that will have an impact on the top leaders of organized labor.
Well, historically, at least a significant portion of the American labor movement has been pretty much behind the empire. You're talking about organizing people against the empire.
That's
right. Is there any hope for at least peeling away some of the unions and reversing the old pro-imperial role?
Yes, I'm convinced of it. But I think you're right, Doug. It is going to be very hard because people are used to the role of playing second fiddle within the empire. And the notion that what's good for the empire is good for us. Challenging that really goes to some fundamentals, including fundamentals of the role of trade unions in this country. And I think on the one hand, this is a very exciting opportunity. I can't remember when we could talk openly about imperialism. At the same time, it's going to scare a lot of people. It's going to challenge the basic precepts of their lives. So I think it's going to be difficult. There's no question about it. My guess is that what we will see is a tendency among some unions and some central labor councils, perhaps even some state federations, to more openly challenge U.S. foreign policy and to begin proposing alternative scenarios. And if we can get that running, off and running, I think we'll be doing a great job.
And finally, I've had you on the show several times now without getting you to talk about what you're working on with TransAfrica, which is the reparations issue.
Yeah.
And that does certainly link imperialism and domestic policy.
That's right.
We're
doing a couple of things.
Yeah, well, what are you working on, and how does it sort of relate to what we've been talking about?
Well, just for those that don't know, TransAfrica Forum is an organization that was the major force in reigniting the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s here in the United States. It was led by Randall Robinson, who was the founding president, who retired in the fall of 2001. What we're attempting to do is to build TransAfrica Forum as a black global justice organization, taking up issues, raising issues that affect the nations and peoples of Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. And there are a couple of campaigns that we're working on right now. One is around Haitian refugees and the disparate treatment that they are receiving at the hands of this administration. When you refugees from Haiti are treated like dogs, whereas refugees that come from Cuba are treated in a completely different way. And it's so obviously cynical, racist, and political. And so part of what we're attempting to do, and with others, is to raise the issue of the treatment of Haitian refugees. The other campaign that we're taking up is in support of a lawsuit that was filed on behalf of Jubilee South Africa and the Kulamani Support Group, which is calling for reparations, corporate accountability, and responsibility by those corporations and banks that directly collaborated with the apartheid regime in South Africa. And so we're very excited about taking these up, and we're looking forward to building these both as grassroots campaigns.
There was a lot of critique of the so-called global justice movement, that it was heavily white, and you heard the same about the peace movement. Do you think this is a way of integrating it a bit?
Yes, I do. The global justice movement in the United States has been largely white. That's true. There have been organizations and activists of color who've played important roles in it, but it has been overwhelmingly white. And while I am critical of the movement for, in many cases, not paying sufficient attention to the issues facing people of color, I'm also critical of many activists of color who I believe have not done a sufficient job of drawing the connections between many of the struggles that we're facing here and the global situation. So you can have white global justice activists who take up issues and ignore the domestic. And unfortunately, there's many activists of color that I've run across that will address the domestic issues but not link them with the global. And so we're encouraging people to do both, and that's something that TransAfrica Forum is advancing, the Black Radical Congress, Black Voices for Peace. There's a number of organizations that are really attempting to, in some respects, emulate the role of W.E.B. Du Bois, who saw no contradiction between taking up the domestic struggle against racism and linking that with the international struggle against imperialism.